We're in the field tonight with Talal Balah, and I've chosen to speak with Talal because we want to devote our time tonight to all the issues pertaining to water, specifically how to store water in case of emergencies, all the ways to purify water, how to reuse your water, all of the water-related issues that all of us need to know. Now, Talal grew up in Lebanon, and he got his engineering background in Lebanon, and he also earned a master's degree at Caltech in civil engineering, and his focus was water resources. So the How to Survive Anywhere book includes a section where we spoke about the different ways to purify water and different ways to observe if the water is good or not. Now, Talal, could you tell us a little bit about your background growing up in Lebanon and specifically about the water issues like we were talking about earlier?
Oh, okay. Well, in Lebanon, we lived through a long civil war. And even though there was water coming from the utility, it wasn't very consistent. Either the pipes were bombed or broken, or the utility, or there was no power to deliver the water. And so most homeowners or apartment complexes, they got their own tanks, put them on the roof, and when the water would come, they would fill these tanks, or they would dig wells and get the water that way. But during the war, when the war would get intense, there would be times when there was no water, and people learned how to store it or clean it or recycle water from one use to another.
So how did you store water then if the lines were broken?
Well, there would be times when the water would come, and then what you did is you had glass jars where you stored your water.
Mm-hmm.
And there, sometimes you even decided, you know what, they said that it's going to be really tough times, so you'd use your bathtub as a storage device.
How did you take a bath?
Well, what you did is, I learned how to take a bath or like a shower from 1 gallon of water. You kind of know how to put the soap on your head and then slowly wash it down and use the water from your head down to your shoulders. And it's amazing how you can actually take a full bath of one.
So that sounds like a military bath.
Like a military bath.
So you used your bathtub to store water because you needed that much water.
You needed the water, yeah. And you didn't use the bathroom because there was nothing to flush it with.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw later that on an earthquake preparedness that actually this is a recommended practice, is when there is no water, what you do is you get plastic bags, like a hefty bag, and you line the toilet, and then when someone uses it, then you just roll it up and close it and put it in the trash. And that way you don't use the water, because the behind the water there's like a 4 gallon container behind the toilet, and that is usable water.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to use the water in the toilet itself, but behind it there's water that you could use to wash your hands.
So the bottles that you used to store water, were they just recycled water that recycled bottles that had food in them or something?
The bottles were like apple juice bottles,
okay,
that size. They were 1 gallon size. Some were bigger. And then sometimes, you know, in your kitchen, you have all these utensils that you normally store in a closet. But what you did in tough times is you took them all out, you lined your counters with them, you filled them with water, and you covered them. You used it. So they were all full of water.
So you just assumed that on some kind of a regular basis you're not going to have water coming out of the tap. You had regular tap water that was potable at some times, right?
It wasn't very regular, but somewhat regular. So whenever it would come, you would do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was water that was well water, which wasn't clean enough to, you know, cook with probably or drink, but you could wash your hands with it or wash your vegetables or something like that.
So this was a separate line that would come into your house?
Yeah, it was water from a well.
Okay.
So they dug a well, and every so often it would silt up or get salty, and they would dig another one.
And what did you have to do before you could drink the well water?
If you needed to drink the well water, you would have to boil it. And
okay.
And sometimes it would be like 20 minutes or before you could drink the well water.
Now, why 20 minutes? Was that the recommendation?
I think there's some kind of there's like a chart that says for that temperature you need this long, and something like 70 degrees Celsius, most of them die within 8 minutes, but mm-hmm. there's still like typhoid or that don't die even after a long boiling.
I see. So there, because I know that the general recommendation here in the U.S. is bring the water to a boil, and most things you've killed by the time you brought it to a boil.
Yeah.
So were these, this was like maybe if a sewer line contaminated, or what was the situation?
Well, normally, like in the U.S. here, you don't percolate water if the water table is within 10 feet, or if it's potable. But back there, there might be older homes that had a septic tank, and there might be sewer lines that hadn't been repaired for a while. And what you wanted to do is you didn't know if there was cross-contamination, because normally the sewer lines here are really deep. So it was always good practice to boil this water. And there would be outbreaks sometimes of cholera or other diseases.
Mm-hmm. So did you have actually long periods of time when you had to use and rely upon your stored water?
Yeah, sometimes more than a week.
Really?
Yeah, so it'd be...
So you really found, you learned by experience how to get by on very little water, it sounds like.
Right.
Because one of the survival books I have says that you should, for emergencies, store 1 gallon of water per person per day. And to me, that seems like nothing. That seems like total bare bones. But would you say that was a sufficient amount in your experience?
Well, see, we think of water as a one use commodity. But actually, if you really have very little water, what you would do is you would, let's say you wanted to wash your face. Well, you washed your face, but the water goes back to the container or a different container. And this water could be used to flush the toilet, let's say. Or if you're washing vegetables or fruit, you could wash it, and now that water can be used to kind of, if you're washing dishes, you could use the same water to do that first time, you know, rinsing off whatever is on the dishes.
So we in the United States are pretty spoiled, because people just let the water flow down in the curb and the gutter, and they don't really pay any attention to it.
Yeah, well, a lot of people value it, and they just use it as gray water. I think there's this fine line that if you crossed it or if you overdid something, you can create disease either for yourself or for your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the rules tend to be very, very stringent, because especially when you have a high concentration of people, then any kind of mistake can just multiply really quickly.
And you were in the urban area where you lived?
Yeah. We were in an urban area. I think our apartment complex had something like 60 apartments, probably 4 or 5 people each. So there was two.
Oh, I was thinking you were in a regular house. You were in an apartment complex.
Yeah, we were in an apartment complex.
So everything is more challenging in an apartment than it would be in a single family dwelling.
Because you have a yard where you can store things. I think in front of us, in front of our building, was one of the last remaining old brick houses. It was 2 stories and it had a huge yard. And I think I left in 88 to come here to do my master's. I think within a year or two it was built over and with another apartment.
I see. So, you know what I thought we would do? Let's go into some of the water observation rules that I quoted you from when I wrote How to Survive Anywhere. And these were common sense observations. You were pointing out if you find water and you're not certain about its palatability, you want to ask yourself if it looks good, if it smells good, if it tastes good. So what are you looking for if you want to see if the water looks good?
Well, obviously, you know, when we drink water, we rely on other people to do these extensive tests. Tests for organics in the water, tests for bacteria, viruses, chlorides. But when we're out by ourselves, we don't have all these tools at our disposal. So the only thing we really have is like a basic common sense about the source of the water. And let's say we've identified that this is probably a spring or a river, and it's probably clean, and there's nobody upstream that's polluting it. Then we can kind of do a secondary test and say, oh, we look at it, is it really clear? Or is there mud in it, or is there algae or that can hurt us? And you know, some algae can be deadly.
But merely looking merely just tells you there's something in it. It doesn't necessarily mean it's bad, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't mean it's bad, but it just tells you, hey, you better do something. And then looking also allows you to plan. Let's say before you get to that point where you have to use the water, you can kind of survey the area around you, know where things are, either way before an earthquake takes place, or if it did take place, but you have some water in reserve, then you might want to walk it at least to know what's out there.
So you're talking about now that in a given area where you live, you should know what the water resources are in the given area case you have to use them.
Right. It would be part of your plan. Let's say you're supposed to have an earthquake plan with your family. You know, I am going to be staying at work because I'm a government employee for 3 days. I may not be able to see you for 3 days, but you guys have to be here. And then when we come, we have this water that we have, I think, like 500 gallons of water that we have stored. But we also know that
this is your employment you're speaking of.
No, here.
Oh, here. That's good.
Yeah. So, but we also know that there's an arroyo close by. It's kind of running very muddy right now. And also a couple of streams that I've actually tasted before and had some water from. So you know where to go get them. And then just that looking, smelling...
What are you smelling for, by the way, when you're smelling?
Well, the smell and taste are very, very related to each other. So if, let's say, a car had broken down just upstream and a little bit of gasoline has made its way. When you look at the water, you can't really see anything. But if you drink that, you can get really sick, depending on the concentration. But basically, your ability to smell can find minute amounts of gasoline. You know, you'd be surprised how accurate that can help.
Right.
You.
Like if you get a little gas on your hands when you pump your gas, that's what you're going to smell.
Yeah, you're going to smell that.
Mm-hmm.
Other smells could be like if an animal has used it as their bathroom, and if you were so thirsty, you just grabbed, you know, put your head in the water and started drinking, and then later you found out what you were drinking, you'd get sick.
Mm-hmm.
Also, your body has innate ability to tell you things that you may not know on a conscious level. So let's say you had drank some similar water or some similar compound in the water before. When you take that first taste, your body would immediately tell you, no, don't drink anymore.
Kind of like your built-in memory, your body's memory.
Yeah, and if in fact it's really bad, you'll feel like an instinctive desire to throw up that water.
Hmm.
So, and I hope we never have to be in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I have seen people who are so thirsty that, you know, they know the water looks murky, they just grab their handkerchief, fold it, you know, 4 or 5 times, put it over their cup and make a little place to pour it through slowly, and then they look at it and they say, oh yeah, it looks clean, and they have drunk it, and you know, you ask them, did you get sick later, and they said no.
So, I mean, how effective would you, percentage-wise, would you say that is, using a folded handkerchief to pour water through? I guess it depends on the water.
Right. I think identifying, you know, when you were walking, if you see that it's muddy and you have the time, you can walk more and more upstream, and you can see little streams feeding in, and maybe one of them seems to be coming out clean. But if it's just standing water, you don't really know what's in it. If it's running water, chances are that there's something always feeding it, and if it's coming from a natural spring, that you'll be able to find clean enough water. And in my line of business right now, I work for the school district. We handle a lot of sites that have water, quote unquote, you know, problems, where there's flooding or water coming out from a wall, and people want to pump this water away. But in an earthquake situation, that's your only source of water, because you can't rely on something coming from, you know, far away like Colorado.
In other words, the pipes that are holding the water. If there's an earthquake, you can extract that somehow. Is that what you're saying?
That's one thing, but it's got, actually there are natural streams, and they happen, oddly enough, they happen where there are faults. And I've seen water that has been tested, like at University High School near Santa Monica.
There's a spring there, right?
There's a Indian holy spring. The Indians come and they have their ceremonies there. And that water was tested, you know, better than most brands. But still, that water, you know, comes out and goes to the drain because people don't know how to use it properly. But if you know that it's there and you know that it's clean, then you can go and, you know, fill up your tanks or head there if there's a drought, because you know that it's going to be there for you.
So in a sense, what you're saying is there are, even in urban areas, there are springs where the water is just flowing, but people just aren't aware of it, so it's just flowing away to the gutter is what you're...
Right,
that's what, you know.
Yeah. So there are sources. And there's another source near our main headquarters, and when I was talking to the environmental people, they said there's a small amount, you know, like one part per billion or whatever of arsenic. Mm-hmm. And they actually pipe that water, pay money, something like $10,000 or every few months to the city of LA to get rid of this water. And then I don't know what the natural amounts of arsenic are in, let's say, a river or a spring. But when I asked that same environmental guy, I said, okay, so you're trapped in this building. After an earthquake, you're really thirsty, you've exhausted all the water bottles you've kept. Would you drink this water? And he said, sure. So you want to know where these sources of water are, just as much as you would want to know how to purify them, you know, by filtering them, by boiling them, whatever is available.
Well, let's just review the water observation. Is, does it look good? Does it smell good? Does it taste good? And then, so now you're getting into your basic water purification. You have three fundamental steps of you know, real simple way to purify the water. And your first one was to filter it. Second was to allow the sediment to settle, and then to boil it. So why do you filter first through a cloth?
Okay, well, there are different sizes of objects in the water. And you first want to filter it to get rid of the larger size, whatever you can remove right away. And then there are particles that will pass through this filter, no matter what size you have. And those normally take a little longer to settle down. So let's say I don't have any water, and the only water I can find is the muddy water that's running right now through the arroyo. It's actually running almost black in color. So what I can do is get a big container and then pour it through some kind of filter material. And then it will look a little bit clearer, but it would still be muddy. And it will take it probably a couple of days for that silt and clay to start settling down. And there are things you can add to it to break those bonds, because this clay material that's inside the water...
What's an example?
The example that's used commercially, I think they call it alum, and I don't know the exact formula right now, but it's a chemical, because the clay are basically really fine particles that have electrostatic charges, it comes in and it gets attracted to the clay material and removes that electrostatic charge, and therefore instead of these particles not wanting to coalesce together, they start to form these conglomerates that are bigger and heavier, and then they start to fall down.
But so in other words, you're suggesting one could add alum to the alum,
yeah,
to the water, And it helps draw out the particulate matter in the water.
It just makes it able to combine together. Hmm. And you can actually see like a little cloud where it starts at the top of the water and slowly move down and down and down, and the water above it is clear and the water below gets murkier and murkier. And sometimes simple things like changing the pH. So if it's water that is basic and not clear, if you add a couple of drops of lemon, you change the pH and all these particles start to attach to each other and fall. Sometimes it's the reverse. So it's too acidic and you add something basic like a little bit of dust from your fireplace and it will make it settle.
You mean ash from the fireplace? Ash from the fireplace. Okay, interesting. Okay, well, good. So, the boiling, that's basically the universal way to purify your water, right?
Right. So, boiling, and if you go to, I think the city of L.A. has a earthquake preparedness manual, and on the back it talks about various steps that you can take. One of them includes purifying water. And by boiling it, you kind of know what temperature it reached because you really don't have a thermometer. But in that chart, it actually shows that you might reach something like 70 Celsius, which is probably 140 or something like that. Most of the organism starts to die within a few minutes. And as you get to higher temperatures, they die faster. But still, there are some organisms that will stay in the water, and boiling them for something like 20 minutes when there's like a typhoid.
So the worst case scenario, you may have to boil for 20 minutes.
Yeah, and if let's say there's an outbreak of a disease, so that wouldn't be sufficient. Boiling would not be sufficient. You'd still need to add like a couple of drops of bleach. And there are in that city of LA Fire Department booklet, they actually tell you to, you know, to use iodine crystals versus bleach versus, and then the amounts, and what you want to do is add these and when you store the water, not when you're just about to use them. So they take their time and then they keep that water clean until you're ready to use it.
Now you brought up an interesting point about really water storage, so maybe we could touch on that a bit. If the water is clean when you put it in a container, there's nothing that's going to develop in there, right?
Well, it depends on what the container is made of. So typically, if it's glass, it's one of the best. And the additional...
And you don't have to buy anything new, just use your recycled juice containers.
You can use your juice containers. So if it's open and it's glass, it's open to air, then it will develop algae.
Stuff will get in there.
Stuff will start to grow in it. If it's closed, then the UV light from the sun will act to further purify it. In fact, if you had no way of boiling it, if you got your, you know, half a liter, I don't know how many ounces, like the little tiny plastic bottle, and you just put it in the sun for half an hour,
it's like 16 ounces or so.
Yeah, 16 ounce bottle. You put it in the sun for half an hour or so. Then the UV light acts to purify it. And then if you're really unsure about its quality, if you put it in a place where it actually also gets warm, you know, like against a black roof or something, then you get the added benefit of that temperature rise. And then you can allow it to cool later.
But so we're talking about water that just for storage. These are methods to store. But if there was any suspicion about the water's purity, you could have it actually in the sun so the UV rays could purify it.
Yeah, the sun or heating it. And then storing it, there are different types of plastic. You probably want to try whatever containers you have and rotate that water to see, before you have an emergency, how heavy it is, where can you keep it, does it slosh back and forth?
Right, because your water is, what, 8 pounds a gallon? 8 pounds per gallon?
Yes.
So if you've got a big barrel, it's not going anywhere.
No, but if there's an earthquake and that barrel isn't tied, just like your water heater, then chances are it's going to rock and then start to roll. It may roll down a hill, or and you won't find that water.
Is there a particular plastic container that you would suggest for people? Because there are different grades of plastic, of course.
I'm not familiar with all the different types of plastic, but the bottles that you would, your regular 5-gallon bottles, they have a relatively stable type of plastic.
This is the bottles that you got water in that you purchased. Is that what you're referring to? Okay.
Yeah, now there's a different kind. There's a kind that's kind of dark blue and clear, and then there's a kind that's lighter colored, and I think it's HDPE or something like that. And that kind, you can almost taste the plastic in the water. And it's much cheaper to buy that, but it will react with your water. And when you add chlorine to these plastics, you can almost always taste some kind of reaction. That when we were talking about different tastes. And chlorine is good to kill bacteria, but it also produces various chemicals that cause cancer.
So in other words, you're drinking plastic.
You're drinking plastic that has been chlorinated, and then that is not good for you. So if you wanted to add bleach, I would put it in something that doesn't react, like a glass container, recycled juice container, apple juice container.
Now, there are food-grade plastics, and I don't know how well they are either. I've not actually seen studies of the different ones, but many of the survival stores will sell food-grade plastics, usually blue barrels for water storage.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen those too. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think for the district, most of the earthquake water is in that kind of plastic container.
And there is this book that I like called Just in Case, How to Be Self-Sufficient When the Unexpected Happens by Kathy Harrison. And she has some really good ideas for water storage and water purification. And she mentions using water bottles that have carbonated water, because the pressure is greater. If they get banged around, they use a higher grade of plastic, and so that lasts a lot longer. I have a friend who actually put a regular water bottle and a carbonated water bottle in the sun, and the carbonated one lasted for a couple of years, but the regular one sprung a leak in about, I think he said, 6 months. So the containers are really important. And so just to jump back a bit, you mentioned the idea that gasoline could get in the water somehow. How would you deal with a situation like that? Because let's say the people in the Hurricane Katrina, they probably had all kind of things like that in their water, and maybe the people in Japan after the tsunami have terrible water problems. How do you deal? Because water, gasoline, you can't just boil out, can you?
Well, it's volatile, so when you boil the water, a lot of the volatile materials will just evaporate.
I see.
There might be some heavier, let's say gasoline would probably have a mixture of different, you know, from alcohol all the way to some heavier. And there might be things that feel oily. The thing is that you'll see those on the surface of your water.
If it's gasoline, they'll come to the top.
Yeah, let's say you boiled it, and then it still smells bad, and you look to the side, you'll see like a little rainbow shining on the top of the water. And if you're really thirsty, if you wait a while, all those will come up to the surface, and if you can skim them, that will get rid of them.
You would skim them like with a towel or something?
You could skim them with a towel. I don't, in a situation like that, you know, where you really needed it, you'd have to boil it. And if you had, like from your fireplace, you had a log of wood that is kind of like charcoals, you can crunch it up as best you can, put it inside a cloth, and pour the water through that. And that charcoal acts as a filter, and it attracts various chemicals. And I think you can see something like that in your regular, the filters that you buy from the store that you put on your tap. When you first turn it on, you'll see a little bit of that charcoal dust come out.
So charcoal itself is a very good agent for water purification.
Right, especially for, like you said, gasoline. Mm-hmm.
Are there any filters for the kitchen or for backpacking that you would recommend, by the way, or styles that you might recommend for people?
I've been interested in that. I've never really tried it myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was more on large-scale filtration mm-hmm. devices. Okay. You know, if you want to make a sedimentation tank or a basin, or I would know how to design that. But on a smaller scale, I tend to, you know, always try to drink the water or filter it myself, because I like to be, you know, I like to drink whatever is there. Most people think that I'm, you know, crazy if I drink the water from a stream or a spring.
It's funny how people are afraid of it all the time.
Yeah.
But that's probably what everybody did forever. And now we think that it's no good unless it comes from the pipe.
You know, what's really funny is that I watched this documentary the other day, and this lady was saying how whatever bacteria is in your gut determines your health and your weight. And then she was recommending that you take this type of bacteria, and somehow it will drive away bad bacteria, because whatever good bacteria is living in your gut is good for you. And I'm going, gosh, it's come to a full circle, where first, you know, people drank the water the way that it was and ate the fruit the way that it came from the tree, and whatever is on it was on it. And then they super bleached everything, so there is nothing living anymore. And now they've come to realize that bacteria is actually good for them, certain types of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And that bacteria that's good just by being there drives out the bad bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So having a good population of healthy bacteria is good for you.
So, I mean, I've heard that our body should be able to deal with some degrees of toxins in the water just naturally, like stomach acids and our bacteria in the stomach. And I don't know if you've heard of this, but are you aware of ways in which our diet actually destroys a lot of those natural bacteria? I mean, like I've heard that carbonated drinks, sugar drinks, do that.
They destroy it, or they...
They flush it out, or they remove it somehow.
Well, the carbonated drink, it's an acid. It's like carbonic acid. You know, when you see these underground caves, they got actually formed by rainwater mixing with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and reacting with the various minerals in the earth. And so it's an acid will kill bacteria. So even if it's a weak acid like carbonic acid, it will kill the bacteria. But for sugars, I think it would have to be like a higher level of sugar, a higher concentration, for it to be toxic to bacteria, and in which case it would probably not be good for you. But I know that when, like jams, you know, one of the ways to preserve it, just like if you add a lot of salt to something, you preserve it. If you add a lot of sugar, you also preserve it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very interesting. Maybe we could address a few of the ways in which somebody could be observant to the water sources around their home and their neighborhood and community. I was thinking while you were talking about one of the obvious ones that is often overlooked is rain. Did you have to rely on rain in Lebanon?
Oddly enough, the main paradigm is that rain is dirty and is something to get rid of right away. And I remember when you apply for a college, they ask you to write an essay. And when I applied to Caltech, they asked me about rain and flood water, and I wrote what I thought, which was that it's really a resource, and it just makes no sense whatsoever to just build this great empty concrete channel, and then once a year or five times a year, whatever the rainstorm's frequency is, flush all this water down.
Like we do here in Southern California.
Like we do here.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the reasons why they accepted me, because they realized, you know, that that's the general tendency, is people want to get away of the flooding danger, but they don't realize that they're actually getting rid of a resource. And I, about a year ago, I went up to Fresno, and there's a very active group there at Cal State Fresno, and they had invited people from the government, federal government, also invited people from water resources in California, and they were talking about how California has these extensive systems of dams to store water, but most of them were empty, and their design storm was what they can capture within a year. So let's say a year in California, in Southern California, you might get 12 inches of rain, and then you have an acre or two or whatever, so that gives you about an acre foot of water. So you have this huge reservoir, you store this acre foot of water, but if it rains a little bit more this year, then your reservoir is already full and you just let it go downstream. And it wasn't designed for handling water from drought to drought. So basically, if you were through this drought and then you have to have enough water for you to live until your rainy season starts again. And that wasn't designed that way, which is kind of really sad.
In other words, our system here in Southern California wasn't designed that way.
No, it wasn't designed that way. It was designed to get rid of the water. You could store it for a year, but it wasn't enough.
So what are you suggesting is needed on the state level?
I think there's awareness now that there needs to be a better management system that's more long-term, especially with changing in the climate. And then this can be done by modeling techniques, you know, where you can see what storms are coming, how much is being stored in these reservoirs, and then it's very, very expensive to build these. But there are places like very close to here, like near JPL, there are recharge basins. So all the extra water that comes down can be stored underground, and something like half of your water supply for a city might come from this recharge water.
Explain what you mean by recharge basin. I think I know what you mean, but maybe everyone doesn't.
Well, we were talking about ways to store water. On a small family scale, you would think about a container where you can store water.
A bucket
or a barrel or a bathtub. If you have extra utensils in your kitchen, you might, you know, open them up, fill them with water, and cover them. If you were told, you know, you would be going to be without water for a couple of days. But on a large city size or a county size, there are areas where there's aquifers in the ground. And the natural way was for the river water to flow heavy in winter and find its way all the way down to the ocean, but at the same time kind of slowly seep into the sand underneath. So this would be your recharge. And let's say in the summer, let's say you're up in the mountains and this recharge is taking place up there. Well, that water that got stored in the sand or in the aquifers inside the mountain will slowly come out as a little tiny trickle, and that would be your spring. And then if you're on a flat land and you recharge the aquifer that way, you would probably need a well. So if you dug a well, you can get to the water that way. You can either, you know, drop a bucket and pull it up or put a pump.
So the one you're talking about locally is the Arroyo Seco, where the dam is, right?
Arroyo Seco, where the dam is.
Devil's Gate Dam?
I think it's if you're walking by JPL when you're walking towards Gold Mesa, I think.
Mm-hmm.
If you look to the left, you'll see that stream come down. Up above it is the intake structure for the water treatment for Pasadena. And down below, you'll see these like berms of elevated ground, and then they fill them up. And then they look like little lakes for a while. And they're like one is slightly above the other, and it's like a staircase. Huge.
Right,
lake.
I know what you mean now. So
yeah.
They look like big natural, they look like little mini lakes, and then the water just soaks underground.
Right, it soaks underground, and then Underground, if you can imagine, you know, same way you have mountains and rivers and streams, underground you have pretty much the same thing. And you might actually have a shape that looks like a lake, a whole entire underground lake, because there might be more of the mountains towards the bottom. There might be things that look like a waterfall, where if the underground water table reaches a certain level, and there's a layer of they call it an aquitard, and when the water goes above it, it starts to overflow, go down to the lower. And in those places that it overflows, it comes up. It might be like a spring there, and that in fact that water that comes from the Pasadena or San Gabriel Mountains, it came down, and the place that that aquitard layer is actually where the downtown Los Angeles started, you know, in 1700s is where that little water was showing up.
And they had all those little, back in the Spanish era, they had all these zanjas, they called them, the little aqueducts that carried the water everywhere.
Yeah, it's a natural way. I mean, people didn't know where the water was coming from, but when you start to take, sections of drill cores, you can see where is sandy, where the water can't flow, and where is it piling up underneath.
I see.
And the other advantage of having it stored in underground is that pretty much all the bacteria goes away. And sometimes, though, water from below the ground can be contaminated with things like arsenic.
So this is, again, on a city-wide level.
Yeah.
Then they pump it out and use for the city. Can you make a few comments about what one needs to be concerned about if you collect rainwater for your home?
Okay. So I attended probably 6 or 7 months ago. The city of L.A. was giving out rain barrels, and it was a community meeting. And I wanted to see, you know, what they were telling the people. And the idea was the city has a mandate from the water board saying you have to clean up the water that's coming from city streets and going into these rivers, like the LA River. And one of the ways to treat this problem is to have to collect the rainwater. So if the water goes into a rain barrel, then it doesn't go on the street, and if it doesn't go on the street, it doesn't wash out the dirt on the street, and therefore it won't end up in the river. But the problem was they weren't educating the homeowners. If you talk to someone, you know, a homeowner, and you tell him, are you using this rainwater? He says, yeah, but I'm going to wait till the first storm comes to wash my roof, and then I'll connect it to my rain barrel, because then it's cleared up whatever settled on my roof from the freeway or dust or whatever problem. But what the city wants you to do is wants you to collect all that waste on your site, even though it may not have come from your house. It might be the freeway right next to you. And what needs to happen is there. Part of giving that free rain barrel should be an education about, okay, look, we're going to give you this rain barrel, and it's only going to be used for using it to water your garden, because it will have some whatever is settled on your roof. But this other water, if you want to use it to drink, this is what things you have to do. You have to filter it, you have to boil it, they need to tell them. And that isn't part of the regulations yet.
So basically, though, if I wanted to collect my rainwater, I can use it for personal consumption, right?
You mean you want to drink it?
I want to drink it, yeah. What do I need to be concerned about?
Okay, well, let's say you live next to a freeway or next to a tree. So the tree will drop leaves, or there might be birds there. There will be bird droppings. And when the rainwater comes down on your roof, it will collect all that, put it in your rain barrel. And you may or may not know that. And so, you know, whatever's in the air, it could be like acid rain, it could be whatever's the factory right next door is spewing into the air. The rain will wash it down. So there's a strong, it's called TMDL, total maximum daily load of various chemicals that are imposed on the city now. You know, it says by 2012 you shall not have more than this chemical in the water. And what they want you to do is collect this rainwater, saying it's pure, but actually it's not. You know, once the raindrop forms in a cloud, it's already not pure, because it needs some bit of dust there for it to start to coalesce up there. So, but once you get it into your rain barrel, if you pass it through the soil, and many studies have shown that within the first inches, maybe a foot, the bacteria there will clear that water, will clean it. And then various grasses also allow for treating various chemicals in the water. So when it comes back up, it's kind of getting more pure and more pure. But there's this delicate balance about, well, it's rainwater, I collected it off of my roof, it's clean. The question is, again, source control. Did you check to see, you know, all the dust has been washed off? Did you see if your roof shingles or the asphalt's kind of like bubbling up and it's coming down? I remember during a heavy rain, I got a cup and I went under, and I put it under the roof, even though it had been raining for hours. And I brought the cup inside, and to my surprise, you know, remember those first three basic tests? You look at the water and it looks a little bit brown.
Hmm.
And you taste it and it tastes like asphalt. So you know, you can depend on this water for watering, but before you could really drink it, you know, you have to be careful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, this is really good. We're actually just about out of time, Talal. And we probably could go on for another hour about things with things that are water related. And in the future show, I'd like to do that. Maybe talk about water recycling and some of the other common observations. So I want to thank you for being here tonight.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right.